And if you trace the chain back, it runs back to our final speaker, whose anniversary is 18th anniversary of sobriety. We are celebrating tonight. My recollection is that last year, Lois said that they had 17 years of drunkenness and 17 years of sobriety. Now they've had one more year of sobriety than they had of drunkenness. Here's Bill. It's in our good old AA tradition that nobody ever makes a speech. Each of us, in his turn, stands before the meeting and speaks out what is in his heart. So we don't make speeches, we make talks. And what wonderful talks these have been. We have heard the speakers talk about that foul disease, alcoholism, the mystery of the ages, how the dilemma has been solved. We have heard them speak of their gratitude to each other, to all our friends. But I think the deeper thing of what they speak, the deeper meaning of it all is this. They have been talking of love that demands no reward. They have been talking about the kind of giving that bears no price tag. And it is on that sort of giving and loving that I would like to dwell a little bit. The other day, the editor of the Grapevine came up and said, Bill, I wish you'd write a 600 or 800 word piece about Christmas. The more I thought it over, the more I got Buffalo. I said, gee, this society of ours is now moved into every corner of the earth. Here, a great many of us are Christians, but many are not. We have Jews who look to Jehovah. Out on the plains, we have Indians who look to the Great Spirit. And now that we have established beachheads in the Pacific Islands, in Asia, in India, in South Africa, we know that we have brothers and sisters who look to Allah and some to Buddha. And I thought to myself, what could anybody possibly talk about Christmas to all these? And then came this thought, by whatever name we call it, we of AA have Christmas every day. In the sense that we give, and in the sense that we receive. Yes? The kind of giving that demands no reward. The kind of loving that bears no price tag. It is hard to imagine the scope and reach of our society. As I came up here on the platform, Al Stecklin handed me a little clipping. It's a letter about a paragraph long from an AA member in northern Greenland to an AA member in northern Alaska. And the fellow in Greenland says to the fellow in Alaska, "In your letter to the mailbag, you made a statement that we wish to challenge about being the furthest north group. Brother, according to us, you should have a southern drawl." We are known as the North Pole Group and are located at the very top of Greenland, within walking distance of the pole, only on sunny days, of course. If it gets too warm for you down there in Alaska, you can always come up here and visit us. Very coolly, you. So, the giving and receiving of the kind that we have in AA has really reached to the uttermost ends of the earth. In most AA meetings, we like to talk about ourselves. I won't be any exception, but I am going to dwell especially on two who were non-alcoholics, and each of them founders, in reality, of this society, because they exemplify a kind of giving and loving that none of us have ever matched, and to which we can only aspire. It is hard, impossible, for me to take in the contrast between what I see before me tonight and which magnified 200 times would be the AAs of the world and their friends. It is hard for me to contrast that with my own state in the summer of 1934 when I lay up here in Towns Hospital, knowing for the first time that I was utterly hopeless and condemned by my obsession to go mad or die. And my mind reigns back over my life. And I ask myself, is drinking the only thing that ails me? I began to wonder. I thought of that little Vermont town where my grandfather had raised me, because my mother and father were divorced. And believe me, in those Yankee towns in the early part of this century, divorce was something. I remember the gossip of the neighbors, how I was made to feel different. I remembered my physical awkwardness, how kids pushed me around in fun. I remember how very depressed and ashamed and fearful I had been as a kid. But after a while that wore off, and a fierce ambition to succeed, to prove to myself and other people that I was as good as they, yet better. That's what seized me. The neighbors said, "This boy is going to go far." They knew not how far down, however. My grandfather thought it was persistence. He used to spur me on. He came to me one day and said, "Will, nobody but the Australians make him throw boomerangs." "Oh, I thought, I will be the first white man ever to make him throw a boomerang." Childish whimsy, you say, nothing of the kind. I worked on those damn boomerangs for 6 solid months. I sawed the head out of the bed to get the right kind of wood to make a boomerang. Meanwhile, I never filled the wood box. I didn't do any schoolwork, but at last I did make him throw a boomerang, and when it came around the churchyard, it nearly cut Grandpappy's head off. Next thing, I go to boarding school. I'm still so physically awkward that the first ball thrown to me on the playing field hit me on the head, and it knocked me down. I wasn't much hurt physically, but when I looked up and saw the circle of grinning kids standing around me laughing at my awkwardness, I was hurt. And again, that old fierce desire to show somebody and to show myself asserted itself. And I shook my fist and I said, I will be captain of your ball team. And there was a great laugh. Well, I have a crooked arm here. I haven't been able to straighten it since those days because I threw so many rocks at telephone poles to be the pitcher of that team. And I was. Grandfather one day said, well, I guess you haven't got much ear for music, Willie. Your Uncle Clarence was good at it, but I don't believe it's for you. Right up in the trunk, I gotta be a violinist now. No interest in music before, no talent. So I fiddled my way through high school. Drove everybody absolutely wild and said I was going to be leader of the orchestra, which I did become, and it was a damn bad band too. And so it went. And in those days, I was terrifically happy because, you see, this fear, this guilt, this inferiority that I had was being matched by achievement. But you'll notice there was a little something very queer about it. And the story gets a little queerer as we go along. What's the next thing? Well, as I said, I'm pretty physically awkward and pretty homely, and the gals, I felt, didn't think much of me. But finally, the minister's daughter became interested in me. You know it is that way around. So I'm very happy now. I have succeeded in the society of my fellows. I am even succeeding in romance, if you will pardon this little intimacy. But one morning, the principal stood up in chapel and he said, with a very grave face, I am very sorry to say that Bertha B. died last night, the first I'd heard of it. I fell into a depression that lasted months. It even ran into a couple of years. Was there anything normal about that? No. Any kid would have been awful blue, but it wouldn't have lasted too long at that age. No, I'm depressed for a couple of years. I don't want to live either. Why? What was the matter? This time I couldn't win. My adversary was death, and I was utterly licked, and I couldn't take it, and I wanted to run out. And this was still years before I even had a drink. I think of one more incident. The World War is on. Lois and I were engaged. The goose hung high again. But then the goose began to hang a little bit low. Because at Plattsburgh, in officer's training, I had determined to go into the artillery, the heavy artillery, the kind way behind the line. Well, in good old Vermont, they have a military tradition that says you go to the wars and you like it. And I was afraid to go, and I didn't want to get killed. So we're on the old steamship Lancashire. We're just entering the Irish Sea. Officers were set on watch at each deck. My post that morning was virtually on the keel of the ship, and I could look up through the spiral staircase and see light breaking through the hatch above. And we had orders that if we were struck, that we officers would have to shoot anybody who panicked. And I sat there and I shivered and I reviled myself for my cowardice. The guilt was something terrific. And all of a sudden there was a crash, as though you stuck your head in the church bell and somebody had hit it with a sledgehammer. And I knew the jig was up. And the men rushed out of their bunks. And I did have to offer to shoot some. But didn't have to. And we knew our goose was cooked. Here we were right on the keel. And then suddenly a great wave of exultation swept over me, compensating once more. Wasn't scared to die after all. I'm rather ashamed to say I rather enjoyed the war after that. Does this make a normal picture? No. Everything assessed in terms of victory or defeat. Well, when alcohol got in the picture during that war, poured into that sort of a personality, what began to happen? If I was frustrated, well, I could, you know, feel better by drinking. Also, if I wished to dream still greater dreams of accomplishment and dream of greater triumphs, I could also drink. And that drinking presently becomes a habit, and it becomes an obsession. I'm back in New York now. Lois and I have a great marriage. But the drinking goes on and on and on. And over there sits an old business friend of mine who got me going in business. And he saw me sink under the weight of it. And I couldn't stop. All I was drinking to cure frustration or to dream still greater dreams. And finally, I'm lying in town's hospital, as I said, and the jig is up. And downstairs, a little doctor with china blue eyes and white hair and very pink cheeks and usually a half smile, but this evening grave, was talking to Lois. Well, she already knew a great deal about the kind of love that had no price tag on it, the kind of giving that demands no reward and gets no reward. She was still living on hope that maybe I'd pull through. And the good little doctor that we all recognize as our beloved Silky was obliged to say no. I'm afraid he's like nearly all who pass this way. Perhaps within a year you'll have to confine him somewhere, else he'll go mad or die. So it seems to me that as a symbol of all those great women who've seen us through in AA and will still see us through and whose love and giving has no price tag, I ought to introduce Lois for a second and let her say a word to you of what she feels and thinks.
Thank you so much. And I want to thank the intergroup and the dinner committee for this grand affair we're having here, and for my beautiful orchid. And I also want to tell you how grateful, and I'm sure you all feel the same way, how grateful as a wife I am for this wonderful thing that is AA. It is 1 year over the halfway mark, or the balance sheet, 17 years of sobriety against the 17 years of drinking. And that 1 year has been a wonderful year. And I want to also thank AA for the wonderful program and wonderful way of life that's made possible for so many wives to know how to gain serenity and happiness. And again, I want to thank you.
So the little doctor who loved drunks had been obliged to pass the sentence on me, under which nearly everyone here, alcoholic, has been under. I went out of that place in fear and trembling. Fear kept me sober a while, but on Armistice Day, 18 years come tomorrow, I was drunk again. You know, it's a funny thing about these anniversaries. This is the 10th, and Armistice Day is the 11th. So this must be the celebration of the time that I determined to get drunk once more. Soon I'm back in the hospital, but not before a friend had come to me saying, well, I got a release from this thing. I got honest with myself. I talked it out with somebody else. I straightened out my jams with other people. I tried some of this giving that demands no reward. I prayed to a higher power, God as I understand it. He'd come with that simple message, one alcoholic talking to another. And that was inside me, I think, deep when I went into the hospital that time. And after 2 or 3 days, I remember falling into a terrific depression. This time I knew it was over. I could not go on. I couldn't swallow this God stuff anyway. Yet I found myself crying out, if there is a God, will he show himself? And then the place lit up. And I was in an ecstasy. And was released from this obsession. And have been ever since. Then comes the little doctor with the china blue eyes. And the half smile on his mouth. And I say, doctor, am I crazy? He talks to me a while. He says, well, I'm a man of science. He said, I don't know what's happened to you, but I can see that something has. Whatever it is that you've got, you'd better hold on to it. Ah, let's stop and think. Supposing the little doctor who loved drunks had been a coldly scientific gentleman, and it tapped his head and said, my boy, you will feel better in a few days. We might not be sitting together here tonight. But no, he gave me hope. He gave me encouragement. I frantically stopped working with other alcoholics. I come back up to him and say, won't you supply me with some doc? Well, now talking God, the drunks in town's hospital in those days just wasn't done. It took immense courage on this little man's part. He risked his reputation for us. He let me come. I worked frantically with drunks, telling them all about this hot flash and about how they should get more moral. Well, the drunks tapped their heads and they walked off. Nothing happened at all for 6 months. And then the little doctor who loved drunks made a contribution to this society that should name him a founder in anybody's book. He said to me one day, look, Bill, he said, you're preaching at these guys. You've got something you aren't able to transmit. He says, you're always talking to me about that book you read back some months ago, called James on Varieties of Religious Experience. And said that the common denominator of all those experiences was calamity, wasn't it? Hopeless people. He said, why don't you throw it into them how hopeless you are? It doesn't do any good for me to tell them that. But supposing you, an alcoholic, tells them that, why don't you tell them that they've got an obsession of the mind that condemns them to go on drinking against their will? An allergy of the body that ensures they'll go mad or die if they do. Put that over your transmission bell and quit the preaching. Then maybe you'll puncture those egos so some of the stuff will run out and your stuff can get in there. Ah, what a vast contribution that was. Things began to look up right away. Soon I'm on my way to Akron. And dear old Dr. Bob was the first guy I really tried it on. And if you'll hear his recording made at Detroit and you'll read his story, you'll notice that he wasn't so impressed with me as a man of great morals and spirituality. He was impressed with me as a drunk who knew what he was talking about on the subject of alcoholism. And Dr. Bob accepted that from me. And he never drank afterward. Such was little Dot's early contribution. I'm told that that man talked in his lifetime with something like 50,000 alcoholics. 5,000 up here in Knickerbocker Hospital. And until the very end of his years, before he left us a year and a half ago, his scientific associates didn't rate him very high as a doctor. But my God, what a great human being. And you know, he was the first one to symbolize that wonderful fusion that is taking place in AA today between the men of science and the men of religion. In those days, we stood in a kind of a no man's land. Here was a rampart of science, and here was another rampart of religion, and, well, there we were. But Silky had it both ways. He said, yes, they got a physical allergy. Yes, they got all sorts of maladjustments. But the cure is moral, and the cure is spiritual. So he could come into the no man's land where we were and be with us. Ah, yes. That little man told us the truth about ourselves, and he dispelled error. And when he had done that, he gave us the beginning of hope, where there had been despair, and with hope came faith in ourselves and in the God who has delivered us. There came light where there had been darkness, and he brought us joy where there had been despair. Such was the little doctor who loved Grumps. Such was he of the china blue eyes and the white hair and the pink face and that half smile that 50,000 of us have seen. I suppose some might say it would be presumptuous to compare a man of medicine with a saint of the church. But for us who knew him, I doubt if anyone would deem it that. I'm thinking of a man, also one of the founders of this society, born in Italy centuries ago, a gay blade, a rounder, could clatter his wine flagon with the best of them, romance as gaily as any, shake the dice with Dame Fortune. Ultimately, he's sick, he's fed up, he's through, and though no alcoholic, he hit bottom just like the rest of us did. And in that agony, he said to himself, supposing I make one rule only for my life. Supposing I try to do literally, every day, just as my master would have done. So, he walked out into the woods and fields and commenced to do just that. He never tried to preach at people or reform people. He just was a man who gave without any demand for the reward. He was a man whose love had no price tag on it. Therefore, he attracted multitudes of people to him, who saw in him doubtless what we've all seen in Selkie. And each one, and they ran into thousands upon thousands, began to try that kind of giving, which demands no reward. Well, to make the comparison, I'll read what somebody wrote in the Grapevine about Selkie. And then we'll read something that Francis of Assisi wrote. Somebody said in the Grapevine, we shall remember him as one of the architects of our well-loved society. The first doctor ever to befriend us, he described the true nature of our strange malady. At peril to his career, he filled us with high hope in our pioneering time. Though a man of science, he boldly set his approval on the book Alcoholics Anonymous, thus prescribing a spiritual remedy for our sinister illness. Over the years that followed, he stood by the bedside of uncounted thousands, the healing art in his hands and compelling love in his eyes. We, the children of the night, knew that he understood, and we followed him out into the light of day. Now then, let us turn back to Francis. And remember that much of the humanity of this movement, its tradition of corporate power, its idea of giving without demand for reward, stemmed also from him. And he was a man, so history says, that in later life became able to practice such a principle almost unto perfection. And he summed up what he felt and what he believed in one of the most famous prayers of all time, which I think it would be wonderful if we had now would now share it with each other. And the prayer of Francis was this: Lord, make me a channel of thy peace, that where there is hatred, I may bring love, that where there is wrong, I may bring the spirit of forgiveness, that where there is discord, I may bring harmony, that where there is error, I may bring truth, that where there is doubt, I may bring faith, that where there is despair, I may bring hope, that where there are shadows, I may bring light, that where there is sadness, I may bring joy. Now, what did Francis ask for himself? Well, nobody can recall that Sophie ever asked for anything, excepting what Francis asked for. And this was it. And the prayer continued. Lord, grant that I may seek rather to comfort than to be comforted. To understand rather than to be understood. To love rather than to be loved. For it is by self-forgetting that one finds. It is by forgiving that one is forgiven. And it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life.